Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. What if, in the middle of Civic Center, or the Haight, or the Bayview, there was a place where people who inject illegal drugs could drop in as needed to use with amnesty? Trained staff would be available to provide clean equipment and teach and reinforce safe injection practices. Medical and behavioral health services, including access to treatment, would be available. Overdoses would be swiftly identified and reversed with naloxone, a safe, affordable, effective opioid antagonist. Not having to fear arrest or stigma, an injection drug users could live a safer, more humane existence, and in some cases, maybe find the support and space to get clean. In April, San Francisco Supervisor London Breed co-sponsored legislation to convene a diverse, multidisciplinary task force of experts to recommend whether the city should implement a safe injection facility in San Francisco. State Assembly Bill 186 would allow 8 counties, including San Francisco, to operate a safe injection facility. It just passed out of the Assembly and is headed now to the State Senate for consideration. And as a model, Vancouver's Insight facility has been successfully operating since 2003, with 0 overdose deaths and an increased percentage of participants going into treatment. It could demonstrate what a safe injection facility could offer communities here in San Francisco. Critics, however, argue that these injection facilities will cause harm by encouraging or increasing drug use. Law enforcement and some community members worry that users will leave such facilities altered and behave erratically in neighborhoods where they are located, causing a threat to public safety. So should San Francisco provide an indoor medically supervised facility where drug users can safely and legally inject? Joining me tonight to discuss the pros and cons of safe injection facilities in San Francisco are Dr. Alex Krall, Director of the Behavioral and Urban Health Program at RTI International, an independent nonprofit research institute dedicated to improving the human condition. Welcome, Alex.
Great to be here.
And we also welcome Gary McCoy, HIV/AIDS activist and recovery advocate. Welcome, Gary.
Hi, thanks.
And we also welcome in studio Laura Thomas, Deputy State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you.
Glad all of you can be here tonight in studio. And we invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on klw.org. or on our Facebook page, and we'll be opening up the phone lines in just about 20 minutes. So, Laura, let me start with you. First of all, what kinds of drugs are we talking about that people would use in these facilities?
Any drugs that people want to do in these facilities, there aren't restrictions or limitations on them. At least the models that we have from Vancouver and other parts of Canada and Europe and Australia, some specifically limit it to injection drugs, and others allow smoking, for example, but there are no limitations on the types of drugs. It's intended for people who are using drugs that would otherwise be illegal for them to use.
So the name injection may be a little bit misleading then, is that correct?
It's one reason why we talk about supervised consumption services or drug consumption rooms for methods of drug consumption that are in addition to injection. But honestly, most of them around the world are for people who are injecting drugs, as is Insight, for example, in Vancouver.
And typically, who uses this service? Is there a typical participant?
There's a typical participant in only in as much as there's a typical person who injects drugs. But the population that, to pick on Insight, because it's been heavily researched and because Vancouver is fairly similar to San Francisco in a lot of ways, people who are already using injection drugs, whether it's heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, a mixture of those, probably people who are homeless or marginally housed, probably people who've been injecting for a significant number of years already. They may have tried treatment at some point in the past, but people who have eroded a number of the social and economic supports in their life already.
And Dr. Alex Krall, you've done a lot of research on this issue. Curious if you can tell us what behaviors we see currently from users and what are the risks with the current system?
Well, I think one of the big risks that's out there right now is overdose, and I'm sure you've heard of this. Since 2000, year 2000, 500,000 Americans have died of overdose. That if you look at these centers around the world, and there's almost 100 of these centers around the world, no one's ever died of an overdose in any of these centers. So that's a big one right there. Mm-hmm. But we're also talking about HIV or hepatitis C, abscesses. There's a lot of other potential health complications related to drug use. Mm-hmm.
And Gary McCoy, I'm sure a lot of listeners probably have their own perspective on this, but what kind of user behaviors are we seeing now in San Francisco that this kind of problem might, that this solution might address?
Well, I can give you a pretty recent example of that. I live in the Civic Center area, and I'd say about a month and a half ago, I was in my living room and I heard someone shouting from the street, and I ran down there, and it was someone that was in one of the alcoves around the corner from my house, and her partner was overdosing. And so it's not uncommon, you know, that it's happening in a lot of our streets and a lot of our doorways, and it's people that aren't able to access resources, and they're not. It's difficult for them to find those sort of resources when they're out on the street. So I say that from experience, myself being an injection drug user in the past for well over a decade before I got sober and slowly got my life back together. It's very common, mm-hmm. in every neighborhood, and a lot of neighborhoods. I've noticed tend to think they're the only neighborhood experiencing these situations on the street, and it's citywide. So, mm-hmm.
And I assume you feel if this kind of facility existed back when you were a drug user, that you would have been happy that this kind of facility existed?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I went through a lot of health problems related to my drug use, and being, you know, HIV positive was one of those, one of those things that happened because of my use, but also, you know, multiple staph infections and blood infections. And I was constantly in the emergency room uninsured for a good portion of that period. And, and I also suffered a lot of mental health issues around it related to my drug use and from being out on the streets. Mm-hmm. So
Dr. Alex Krall, I wanted to go back to you. You mentioned overdose as a big factor for wanting to have these facilities here to help guard against overdoses. Is the sort of the health of the user the big argument for having these facilities, or are there other benefits that these facilities could bring?
You know, there's really two levels of benefits for these. The first is for the health of the people using these drugs, as we talked about. But the other is just also the benefit of the community. And the community level benefits are huge here. And a lot of the research that's come out of Vancouver has shown less crime in the area. There's less needles on the streets. There's a lot of sort of public nuisance, if you will, issues that were also solved by people not being out there. And I have to say, I work downtown. Every day I walk to my office, I see someone injecting out there. It's not a great thing to have to see. But also from the other side, the people who are using drugs also don't want to be there. They don't want to be injecting in front of anybody else either. And so I think this is a way of solving this issue for really everybody. To me, it's a bit of it's really a win-win.
Mm-hmm. And Laura Thomas from the Drug Policy Alliance, let me go back to you. We're talking about these facilities, but we haven't really explained to listeners what they are. Can you describe for our audience what a safe injection facility would look like? I mean, what would a visitor see when walking in for the first time?
Sure. I'll explain to you what InSight in Vancouver looks like. It's just one model among many, and I can also say why I think San Francisco will probably develop a different model. But what happens when you walk in to InSight in Vancouver, if it's your first visit there, you do a brief intake, and they get some basic demographic information from you. After that first intake, you just give them your name or identifier and tell them what drug you have. You may have to wait a little bit, but ideally you don't have to wait very long. And then you go into the injection room. It's sort of a cliche at this point to say it looks a bit like a hair salon, but it kind of does. It's got stainless steel booths and mirrors. There's a nursing station in the middle of the room that has all of the sterile injection equipment that anyone would use, including syringes and cookers and so on. People get the equipment that they need, sit down at one of these booths, and will prepare and inject their drugs the way that they normally do. The nurses are on hand. They have peer support workers. If someone has an immediate medical issue like an abscess, they can go see the nurse right away or get an STD test or get a referral for something. And once people are done in the injection room, they go into another area that's often referred to as a chill-out space, and that's for people to sit there until they feel comfortable leaving. It's an opportunity to engage with them. At Insight, they claim it has some of the best coffee in Vancouver. You can get a cup of coffee, maybe some donuts. And if you've got questions at that point or other concerns, you can ask them. One of the great things about Insight is that they work very hard to make sure that substance use treatment is as accessible as possible. And one way they've done that is by opening a detox on the second floor. And so everyone who goes through there knows that if today's the day when they want to make a change in their drug use, that they can go and enter the detox. So that's part of how it operates at Insight as well. So that's the sort of basics of how someone would go through there.
So it feels maybe like a medical facility then, not a party place then from what you're describing?
It's not a party place. Yes, it definitely feels like a medical facility. It's welcoming. It doesn't feel cold or off-putting, but it also definitely feels like you're there for a service. You're not there to spend a lot of time.
And so when people, after they use, they go into a room, are they interacting with other users? I mean, do people tend to sort of turn it into a party-type place once they're in that second room?
Not that I've witnessed. Also, I think when we're talking about people, for example, people who are opioid dependent, who've been injecting for a long time, they're not injecting their drug in order to really to get high or feel euphoria. They're using that substance in that moment to stop withdrawal and to stop themselves from feeling sick. So they're really just trying to get themselves back to equilibrium rather than necessarily feeling what anyone might call high.
So is it pretty ordered in that room then? I mean, is there concern around violence breaking out? I mean, I assume you've got different types of drug use going on. People are going to have different reactions. Is that a concern or something that they have to monitor?
You know, people have different reactions to all sorts of things. At Insight, one aspect of it is that the staff there are very well trained. They know everyone. They know how to engage with people. The other thing is that the drug users in Vancouver fought very hard to get this space opened, and they want to continue it. So they're unlikely to do anything that's going to jeopardize the ongoing success because it's a victory. Its existence is a victory for the drug users of Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. And how would the clients obtain their drugs before they go in there?
Same way they are now.
So illegally. Assuming that's, you know, they're using illegal drugs.
Yes. This is why heroin-assisted treatment or providing pharmaceutical heroin as a treatment is the next stage of this, perhaps, where people aren't having to engage in any illegal activity to acquire their drugs.
And you mentioned that there's nurses on staff. So is that the kind of staff member presence there? You've got doctors, nurses, or are there other people on staff there who are helping out?
Yeah, peers, support workers, people with different kinds of mental health training.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Dr. Alex Carr, let me go back to you on some of the statistics around this model of a safe injection facility. I mean, how do we know that this model is helpful and not harmful? I mean, I got one comment that from a listener on our Facebook page that this is essentially helping people do harm to themselves. So how do we know that this isn't just encouraging people to continue that harm?
Yeah, the center in Vancouver is probably the best researched medical intervention related to drug use in the world. They have published probably up to towards 50 articles in peer-reviewed journals, the top medical journals you can think of. And they've really thoroughly evaluated all the positive and potential negative consequences of it and really haven't found or come up with any of the negative consequences related to it. You know, there's a lot of people who get off of drugs by coming to the center. I think that's one of the big pieces that that people need to keep in mind is, you know, they're sending 400 or 500 people into drug treatment a year, people who might not have entered drug treatment otherwise. It's tough to enter drug treatment if you're on the streets, and it's tough to trust the medical establishment in general. You may not have had good experiences with people in the medical establishment. And so having this as sort of a touchstone, a way to start really starting to engage people in a respectful manner and on their terms with time, it opens them up to the possibilities that maybe there's something else that I can be doing. Maybe there's something else out there for me, and that might be drug treatment. So I think, yes, I understand the kinds of concerns there are, well, you know, but I think overall what we're finding is positive effects.
Isn't the evidence hard to gather? I mean, it's hard to know kind of what would have happened without this facility, right?
That is true, and That's a good point. We don't know what would happen to any person who didn't go in. You know, the research up there, essentially what they do is they follow a cohort of people who inject drugs in the city, and then some of them are using the center and some of them are not. And so what they're doing then is comparing what are the behaviors or what are the changes in behaviors or changes in health outcomes among those people who are reporting that they are using the center compared to those that don't. But still, it's not we can't sort of, you know, obviously prove what would happen if they didn't use it or if they did use it. But it's really the top science. I mean, these are published in the New England Journal of Medicine, British Medical Journal, Lancet, really the top journals. Mm-hmm. So
is it just this Vancouver facility? Are there other facilities that they can use to draw upon evidence to publish some of these findings? Or is it really just Vancouver that's the model that we're talking about right now?
Yeah, so there have been upwards, close to 100 of these centers around the world at this point. As Laura mentioned, in Europe, Australia, and in Vancouver in Canada. There are more about to open in Canada, Toronto as well, I believe Montreal as well, yeah, about to open as well. A lot of the European programs have not been evaluated as thoroughly, and I think we point a lot towards the Vancouver one because it's the best evaluated one, and it's the most likely to have a similar type of context and environment as we do here in the U.S. The Sydney program has also been evaluated quite well as well, and you know they look at really a lot of issues, everything from you know reducing 911 calls and. I mean, there's a lot of different things that they've looked at, mm-hmm. and again, we haven't found any negative consequences.
And Gary McCoy, HIV/AIDS activist and recovery advocate, we've talked a bit about the stats around this. I want to talk about public opinion, and I hope to hear from listeners in just a few minutes when we open our phone lines. But what are the typical concerns that you hear from the community when this topic comes up?
Well, you know, it's. A lot of the same concerns, honestly, and what I hear a lot from people when I speak to them in my day to day is you know this is going to promote drug use, and I sort of, you know, being somebody that has used drugs for a long time, like for me, my discussion with them is, you know, this isn't going to promote drug use. I can't imagine having been through addiction for a very long time and in recovery from it that had I had the choice to either start using drugs and going into a facility or staying sober, like, is that really a choice that I would, you know, would I throw everything away to start using drugs just because I can do it in a supervised facility? You know, I and when I explain that to people, it starts to make sense and it starts to click. But, you know, I think, you know, I myself I opposed this when I initially heard it. I didn't do a whole lot of research. I think my knee-jerk reaction was, you know, absolutely not. And then and I did this publicly about a year ago, and I got phone calls from a lot of friends that have been researching this and have been very familiar with it, and they connected me with the research around it. And you know, I almost immediately changed my mind, and I've been behind it since. And so I think once people get past the initial sort of knee-jerk, like, this is a terrible idea reaction, and actually read into it and do some research and listen to the advocates that have been working on this for quite some time, it's common sense. It makes sense.
That's a pretty interesting knee-jerk reaction that you had, of all people, given that you know you are a recovering user. What was the reason why you had that knee-jerk negative reaction?
You know, I just didn't know how it would work. As somebody, you know, previous jobs, positions with the city doing policy work, it didn't make sense to me without knowing exactly how it would work.
I mean, were you concerned this would encourage more drug use, or did it seem like a waste of resources? I'm just curious what was the initial reason why.
I didn't think it would encourage drug use. I think there was a portion, a little bit of my thinking was that it you know, would it be a liability to the city? And you know, and after learning more about it, you know, we've got other things that, you know, the city provides that is, you know, probably more of a liability than actually providing resources to people to, you know, potentially go into detox or to, you know, have clinicians available if they're having other health issues and things like that.
So it sounds like you're maybe thinking more with your city hat on in terms of liability. Okay, makes sense. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're discussing having a safe injection facility in San Francisco. We're joined here in the studio by Alex Krall, Director of the Behavioral and Urban Health Program at RTI International, Gary McCoy, HIV/AIDS activist and recovery advocate, and Laura Thomas, Deputy State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. So we want to open the phone lines now and invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Would you support having a safe injection facility in your neighborhood? The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. So we have a couple of comments from our Facebook users, and we thank those who are on our Facebook page, City Visions. So Sheldon Duran asks, why wait to shoot up in a clean, indoor, medically supervised facility when users are allowed to shoot up in BART stations and in my doorway? So Laura Thomas, did you want to respond to that comment?
Well, I think no one really wants to be shooting up or injecting their drugs in a BART station or a doorway, and they would much prefer to do it in a safe, clean place. So that's why we want this, for both for the people who are injecting drugs and for people like your caller, who it sounds like doesn't want to be seeing that in BART stations or doorways. And, you know, that's not what BART stations are for. And so we need to be providing alternatives.
Mm-hmm. And we have another comment from J.P. Keller, who says, no, rehab would be the way to go. Why should taxpayers have to pay for an illegal, unhealthy addiction and a lifestyle that is just unheard of? So, Alex Krall, why don't I let you respond to that? I'm sure you hear that response. What do you usually say to people when they say their taxpayer dollars shouldn't go to these kinds of facilities?
You know, we completed a study that was published in a peer-reviewed journal called Journal of Drug Issues this past winter, where we essentially imagined what it would be if we placed the exact same type of facility they have in Vancouver in here in San Francisco, and we looked at the types of savings, the costs that would incur, and the kinds of savings we would have by reducing things like overdose, HIV, viral hepatitis. And what we found was that San Francisco would be annually saving $3.5 million if they had just one of these centers, just like the one in Vancouver. So yes, it would cost the taxpayers money to start one of these, but even including all the costs of it, annual savings would be $3.5 million a year. So I think actually if the concern is tax money, we should definitely have some of these. The other piece that they mentioned there was about drug treatment. We should be doing drug treatment instead. And it isn't one or the other. In fact, this is a great way to move people into drug treatment, to get them comfortable again with medical professionals, and to talk to them when it is they're ready to do it. And when people are ready to go to drug treatment, then have that available.
And Gary McCoy, did you want to weigh in on this, this comment?
I did, you know, and Alex absolutely touched on it. You know, for me, you can't force somebody into rehab. And, if it were that easy, I probably wouldn't have used for as long as I did. But for me, it was building a rapport with people and some of my providers and, getting that discussion going and starting dipping my toe in kind of the harm reduction pool. And so it's not as easy as just, putting people into rehab. They have to be willing. I had to be willing.
So it's got to be that kind of interim step there. Right. So let's go to the phone lines. I see a bunch of callers coming in now. Let's go to Holly on line one. Holly, you're on the air for City Visions. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, it took a second since the Warriors up by over 20 points here almost. I just wanted to know what needs to be done to educate the community neighborhoods better because of the stigma that drug users face. A lot of people don't understand this type of program, and I was wondering what you guys are going to do to try to educate the community so that the stigma can, decrease and they can accept this type of program as it apparently saves lives if you read all the research.
So thank you, Holly, for that question. So Laura Thomas, let me throw that one to you. You're out working on the Drug Policy Alliance. What are the kinds of messages that you want to put out there to just, address this concern around the stigma that community members may have?
Yeah, and I think, the stigma around drug use is bigger than this particular intervention or this particular program, and it's something that we need to address as a society in much broader ways than just this. And this isn't going to necessarily fix it, but we've got, drug prohibition as a whole is interrelated with the stigma around drug use, with the racism that underlies the war on drugs. And so trying to get out into communities and talk about drug use, educate people about the reality of why people use substances, why they develop problems, why they don't. It's been frustrating in working on these types of issues to run into either members of the general public or particularly when it's legislators who don't really understand why people use drugs or why they develop problems. And it's not a sign of weakness or moral failing, that it's actually a health condition, and it's often related to trauma and other things. So just trying to educate people about what drug use is and why people use drugs.
And Gary McCoy, I'd like to throw that question from Holly to you too as well. What do you kind of see as effective messages around the stigma issue?
Well, for me, I've been able to just use my experience, and so a lot of people that I talk to on a daily basis are people that are recovering addicts. So it's a little easier to bring them on to this idea. It tends to be easier for me to discuss this with people. So there's not a whole lot of stigma with people that I already have daily interactions
That makes sense given your background and experience with the issue. Let's go back to the phone lines, and I want to thank Holly for that question. But we have John on line two. So John, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you.
What's your question for the panel?
I'm wondering if, in the plans or in the studies of existing centers, if drug test kits for, dangerous substances are made available. This is something I know that I've seen in the Netherlands, and thought it made a lot of sense. If you're gonna do drugs but you're getting them illegally, how do you know what you're putting in your body? Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if that's been part of anything.
Okay, great question, John. Let me pass that one to Alex Krall. Alex, did you want to address that question about this Netherlands experience of having safe drug kits?
Yeah, one of the big concerns we have in the U.S. right now is this fentanyl epidemic. I'm sure you've heard about it. A lot of the overdoses nowadays that are responsible for a great many deaths are related to fentanyl, which is essentially, it's fentanyl-laced drugs, whether it's heroin or other drugs. And that's such a potent drug. It's 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin itself. And so it's a big concern if you have fentanyl in your drugs and you don't know it, that that's what's leading to these overdoses. So the community response has been that there is actually a fentanyl strips that originally was used for urine testing. And then what it turns out is that you can actually use them also to test your drugs. And so just like John here, the caller, spoke about, the center up in Vancouver has been handing out these fentanyl strips. Crazy enough, I believe the research that they found immediately last month is almost 85% of their heroin that they were testing up there had fentanyl in it, which is that is quite a concern, which is why they are seeing a lot of overdoses up there. More locally here, they're starting to hand them out at needle exchange programs as well. I know they, I think they were starting just yesterday in Oakland. Do you know if the product here in San Francisco, Laura?
Yes.
I think they're started as well. So fentanyl has been the big one that people are testing. They're most worried about at this point. One of the concerns and limitations of that test right now is that it tests yes or no if there is fentanyl there, but it can't test the amount that there is in there. But given how potent it is, you really want to know if you have if your drug solution does contain it. So,
Great. Well, great question, John. Thank you for that. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing having a safe injection facility in San Francisco. We're joined in studio by Dr. Alex Krall, Director of the Behavioral and Urban Health Program at RTI International, Gary McCoy, HIV/AIDS activist and recovery advocate, and Laura Thomas, Deputy State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. The phone lines are open, and we invite you to call in with your questions or comments about safe injection facilities and your feelings around that or questions around that. The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. Let me go back to the phone lines. We're joined by Peter. Peter, thank you so much for dialing into City Visions. What's your question for the panel?
Oh, good evening. My dear sister struggled with heroin addiction for many years and subsequently died, but I think a lot of us who live in this part of the world would like to consider ourselves progressive and compassionate. And if we have the capability of creating a facility like this, I think it's the only humane thing to do.
Well, Peter, I'm sorry for your loss of your sister, and I appreciate your comment. Gary McCoy, do you hear a lot of supportive comments like this? I mean, what's the sort of temperature out in the community in San Francisco around this kind of facility, you know, coming into neighborhoods?
I do. I hear a lot of supportive comments. You know, I have personally lost probably a dozen people to overdoses in the last 4 or 5 years alone, and so a lot of people a lot of my close friends and people that are out in the community, you know, everybody has been touched in some way by the epidemic, and so there's definitely a lot of support for it in the communities. I myself actually overdosed quite a while ago, and it was in the bathroom of a gas station, and so it's pretty demeaning, and it's a terrible feeling to know that for me I was in that place. And so anything we can do to help continue the conversation to bring more support for this idea, like it's definitely been something I've enjoyed doing for a while now.
So in addition to just the physical health and safety, it sounds like there's a dignity aspect to this as well.
Right.
So we did get a comment from a listener who said there already is a safe injection facility in San Francisco. It's called The Union. Let's see. Laura, are you familiar with this facility? This is news to us here at City Visions, but anyone familiar with this?
Yeah, San Francisco doesn't have any authorized legal supervised injection services. We do know that there are a lot of people injecting in bathrooms. For example, I mean, Gary's example, but at the McDonald's bathroom, the public library bathrooms, and, you know, that's part of the problem. Bathrooms aren't safe places to be injecting. They're not always the most sanitary places, and we want to make sure they do provide an amount of privacy and security in a bathroom, but it's still not very safe, especially when you're thinking about overdose risk. One of the main things you tell people who might be overdosing or are using drugs, don't use alone. Use with someone else who can have naloxone on hand to revive you if there's an overdose.
Mm-hmm. So we were also, just to add, we were doing a study asking people about places that they were injecting and bathrooms and so forth. And, you know, strangely enough, one of them said that the public health department bathroom as well. So I don't think any place is I think every place is game. You know, if there's a bathroom and, people, unfortunately, they need to find a space to use, they'd rather not use outside. Again, I think that shows you that we do need these sorts of places, but bathrooms are really the worst place for people to be injecting, because often they'll be going in there by themselves, and if they're overdosing, then they may very well die. And so if we can just get them into a place that's designed for this, and have people, you know, medical professionals who are supervising it and making sure people are okay, I think that's what we need to do. And I think that's the sort of answer to questions about, well, why would you want to do this? It's already happening. It's just not happening supervised.
And so at least as far as we know, there is no other safe injection facility like this, although we haven't heard of the Union. But this would be a new facility brought into San Francisco to counter these otherwise, you know, random places that people are having to find a spot to use. Let's go back to the phones. Barbara from South San Francisco. Barbara, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. I wanted to know if there's someone that is directed to speak to the community that you could contact for a presentation in a community meeting.
So Laura, sure. Thomas, Drug Policy Alliance, do you want to answer that question?
Yes, I'm happy to do presentations. I'm happy to come to community meetings. We've got a group of people who are available. You can reach me. Is it okay to give out my email? lthomas@drugpolicy.org, and reference this show, and we'll figure out how to get someone to your community group or meeting. And that goes for anyone out there who's listening, who wants to hear about this. We want to have more conversations in the community about this. And we know, you know, as Gary said, there can often be a sort of knee-jerk negative opinion on this. But once people talk through it and really hear the research, so we know we need to have a lot of conversations in the community about this.
And Gary McCoy, did you want to weigh in on this? Not necessarily wearing your city hat, but you know, if you get questions around presentations or, you know, further resources for people who are interested in this.
No, I'm not good at the at presenting, so I'll leave that to Laura and of the other professionals.
So we've got one great option here for listeners who would like to have a presentation or learn more about this. And we just got that caller who I mentioned, the Union. Turns out it's a needle exchange site. It's not a safe injection facility. So just wanted to clarify that. We also have on the phone lines, and I want to thank Barbara for that question. We also have Jake in San Francisco. Jake, thank you for calling into City Visions.
Yes. I was wondering if you all knew that Dianne Feinstein is right now co-sponsoring a bill for a mandatory minimum sentence on opioids, and also just a statement, the only way to really repair everything is to legalize. That way you can go in and buy over the counter as an adult, consenting adult, whatever you need, and you know the strength. You wouldn't be running the risk of ODing because you batch that you just received is super strong or cut with something. Mm-hmm. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Jake, for that question. Laura Thomas from Drug Policy Alliance, are you familiar with this Dianne Feinstein bill? Is this accurate about what she's sponsoring?
Yes, and it's extremely unfortunate. We know from very sad experience that things like mandatory minimums and increasing criminal penalties don't do anything to stop drug use or to help people who are using drugs get better. And in fact, it's quite the opposite. They tend to drive people into the shadows, end up with people going to jail and having criminal records. It's extremely unfortunate that Dianne Feinstein has chosen to ignore all of the decades of evidence and is going in the wrong direction on this. It's, you know, this is what Jeff Sessions has been promoting: mandatory minimums, increasing penalties. He wants to go back to the war on drugs that we used to have under Reagan and Nixon, and that way lies a lot of death and destruction.
And the comment around legalization makes me ask, you know, these are illegal drugs. How does this facility work, given that we have a legal regime in this country where, you know, for the most part, we're talking about illegal drugs? So how can this kind of facility exist within the laws of this country?
Yeah, and it's one of the things that we're trying to do to address that here in California is to pass a piece of legislation, which you referenced earlier, AB 186 by Assemblymember Susan Eggman. And it would create some limited legal protections for anyone who's participating in a program like this or the staff or the program that's running it. That would mean that they weren't vulnerable to criminal charges for possession or use of substances or allowing people to use substances while they were in the program. So we're trying to address that. It's similar to what we did around needle exchange in the early days to provide protections from paraphernalia laws around possessing syringes. And obviously, you know, California has chosen to go our own way when it came to medical marijuana first and now recreational marijuana. So laws can be changed.
So it's going to take that state legislation first and then the local governments can follow through then, it sounds like.
Yeah, although we also have the example right now of Seattle in Washington State, which is moving forward with this, and they're in the process of trying to identify two locations to open. They're not changing state law, but they're moving forward on their own legal authority.
Great. Well, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight, we're discussing having a safe injection facility in San Francisco. We're joined by Alex Krall, Director of the Behavioral and Urban Health Program at RTI International, Gary McCoy, HIV/AIDS activist and recovery advocate, and Laura Thomas, Deputy State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. That number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you aren't able to call or don't feel like calling in, you can always email us at cityvisionskalw.org, cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on our website at kalw.org or on our Facebook page. Let's go to the phones. Grace, welcome to City Visions. It sounds like you were the one who was calling in about the union, so we'd love to hear from you. You're our mystery caller.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you for
calling. Yeah, Median is it's a great place. It is a safe injection spot, and it's anonymous. They also, it's a needle exchange as well. It's in the Dandelion on Turk.
Okay, so that's helpful information. Needle exchange seems like, you know, kind of a step in this direction. Alex Krall, do you want to talk about some of the research around needle exchange? Is that sort of a gateway drug, sorry for the expression, to these safe injection facilities?
Yeah, we've been conducting research on needle exchange pretty much since the early 1990s. Found, you know, we did some of the early research that showed that it works for people. It gets them to stop sharing syringes, reduces HIV, and in San Francisco now we've had a needle exchange program since 1989, November of 1989, and there's many different kinds of programs at this point. There's the city is funding a lot of different programs, some of them in the Tenderloin, some of them in the Mission, Bayview. They're pretty much all over the place, and they've been really successful. And you know, we've really been able to cut the HIV rate a lot. You know, it was going up before needle exchange started. It was about 7% among people injecting drugs, and then it went to 14%. And then we started the needle exchange programs, and at that point, it's basically slowly gone down now. And I think we're probably closer to about down to 5% or so. So we've really been able to stem the HIV epidemic in San Francisco and in programs all around the country based upon that. These programs that we're talking about now, which people get these confused all the time, and I understand why, and I sort of make the point once in a while that I think everyone already thinks that there are supervised injection centers, and they're called needle exchanges, and so I kind of get this all the time. In fact, I've even met people who do drug research who thinks that they exist in the U.S. It is a bit confusing in terms of these kinds of names and what's going on in them. You know, the needle exchange programs are basically, you know, they're handing out sterile syringes in exchange for ones that have been used and other kinds of services as well. And they're essentially, some of those are indoors at sites, and some of them are even on street corners. But they're not that different from a supervised injection site in the sense that you're just not seeing somebody actually injecting them in front of you and supervising that, which is really the next step we want to take, is get the people off the street and get them supervised when they're doing these drugs that can be quite dangerous, especially if they're including, you know, if they have things like fentanyl in them. Yeah.
So, Grace, you're not the only person who would assume that a needle exchange program is a safe injection site, but thank you very much for that call. And actually, that call leads me to a topic that I was hoping to bring up. And Laura Thomas, question for you on this. Actually, it's related to the needle exchange, because I'm wondering if programs like needle exchange have helped build the political will now to kind of take this next step into a safe injection facility, or at least at the very least, if you could explain kind of why this is happening now. What's the sort of political moment here that we're in to make this a relevant issue?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely part of it. People have become more and more accepting of the role of syringe access programs and harm reduction as part of our public health continuum. And people have, you know, when we first started syringe access and legislation around syringe access, we were assured that the sky was going to fall and people were going to, you know, immediately start using drugs and all sorts of horrible things would happen. None of that happened. And in fact, as Alex just said, HIV rates have gone down. People have been connected into treatment. And so people have seen positive impacts from syringe access and other harm reduction programs. So I think that's definitely part of it. I think the other piece is the overwhelming sweep of overdose deaths and the ways in which overdose deaths are going up and up and up and up. And people are reaching for different solutions. What we've been doing hasn't been working, and people are in some parts of the country really desperate for different solutions.
So you think this is actually a response to the opioid epidemic?
I think that's part of it, yes.
Well, it's interesting that San Francisco is considering going this way when you just mentioned how the federal government is really going the opposite way of trying to punish users and increase the penalties. And it sounds like actually our own home state U.S. senator is going in that direction as well. And along those lines, how could the current federal administration impact, you know, these types of efforts? I mean, is there a fear that a Jeff Sessions Justice Department could intervene and prevent San Francisco from taking this step?
You know, I think that we all of us in the U.S. have a lot to fear from Sessions and from this administration. But I'm counting on California being willing to say no, we're going to do the right thing, and San Francisco saying no, we're going to do the right thing, and we're going to take care of our residents here. I do think that, you know, this administration has a number of other issues and concerns and distractions, and they haven't even fully staffed the U.S. attorneys for this area. So it's not clear to me what kind of response they're going to be able to mount. I also, you know, California has gone on record as being opposed to the federal law around medical marijuana and recreational marijuana, and Prop 64, which just passed in November, obviously is a very good example of San Francisco and California saying we want to do this differently, and the people who live here deserve to have a different response.
And so maybe as part of the thinking that San Francisco and some of the other counties that might be authorized by the state legislation could set an example that might influence statewide other states and create a sort of a counterexample to the tough on crime rhetoric you hear?
Yeah. I mean, the you know, tough on crime is such a failed policy, and it's very clear that it's a failed policy. But often people aren't quite sure what else we should be doing instead. And so that's part of why supervised consumption services, heroin-assisted treatment, naloxone distribution, a number of other things that do have an evidence base behind them can be a better solution.
And Gary McCoy, wanted to go to you to ask how this type of program might fit in with other San Francisco public health priorities.
Well, you know, harm reduction is an enormous tool to get people in, and this is certainly, you know, falls in the category of harm reduction.
And can you just define harm reduction for people who aren't familiar with that term?
Well, for me, harm reduction, when I first before I decided that I was going to go abstinent from drugs and alcohol was sort of managing it and checking in on my use and things like that, and going to needle exchange on a regular basis, and staying in contact with counselors and people that were on site at those programs. And you know, at the time, I wasn't ready to completely quit. It took a while for me to realize that, you know, that I could actually live a decent life sort of abstinent from everything. You know, and like I said, that was definitely a harm reduction approach. And so I think this is definitely an important tool. You know, and we owe it to, you know, the constituents in San Francisco, to our residents, and to our drug users and drug addicts, to make sure that we're at least giving them the same opportunities to get ahead and to get back on their feet. And you know, to make sure that they know that these programs exist when they're ready.
So this is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. We're discussing safe injection facilities in San Francisco and the prospect for introducing them. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@KALW.org or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. Gary McCoy, I wanted to ask you another question. You'd mentioned that you used to be a user, and if this kind of facility had existed, you would have been really happy to have it in existence. Can you explain what are the sort of concrete ways that this facility would have improved, you know, your life at that time?
Well, I know there's a lot of what ifs involved there. You know, I don't know exactly what my life would look like right now if this had existed when I was using, but I do know that I probably wouldn't have spent a lot of time trying to avoid public places and avoid you know, my medical care providers and missing out on appointments, and always worried that my use was, I was going to be criminalized from my use because I was. And you know, I think, you know, I am the person I am today because of a lot of my struggles, but I lost a lot, and I went through a lot, and I put my family through a lot. And I think anything that we can do to make sure the next person that's facing those same things don't have to experience a lot of the pain and really the, you know, the darkest corners of San Francisco. You know, I would have been happy to have this facility to go to so that I could, you know, get back on my feet much sooner. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's also just being able to check in with people and my own peers. You know, I spent a lot of time when I was using, it was just me and one other person, if that, and that's really difficult to go through. And it definitely affected my mental health quite a bit. And so, there was a lot of wreckage to clean up when I got sober, and, you know, I just like the next person to at least avoid a lot of those struggles if they can. And we have the resources available. Now we need this as a tool to grab those people that we otherwise wouldn't be able to bring in.
Mm-hmm. So it's that human element that it's easy to lose sight of when you talk about statistics and these policies and politics and everything else. So I appreciate you sharing that. Laura Thomas, wanted to ask you, I mentioned in the top of the show that San Francisco is setting out this task force to look into this. Can you explain a little bit about the status of that task force, what the timeline is supposed to be, what people can expect from that task force?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the task force was created by Board of Supervisors President Lyndon Breed, introduced the resolution. It was co-sponsored by Supervisors Ronan Kim and Sheehy, and it passed unanimously at the Board of Supervisors. It creates a 15-person task force that has 90 days to meet and develop a set of policy recommendations for the Board of Supervisors and the mayor. So Alex Krall and I are both members of the task force. Its first meeting is this coming Thursday. It's going to be Thursday, 9 a.m. at 25 Van Ness. Members of the public are welcome to come. And we're going to be going through the specific asks that were made of the task force in the legislation from the Board of Supervisors, looking at the pros and cons of this. Would this be a benefit to San Francisco? And if so, what are the recommendations that we would make to the city?
So then the city would debate your recommendations and decide at that point Is that correct?
Yes.
And do you have to wait for that state legislation to pass before the city can act? Or is the city, do you feel the city has legal authority to act now if it wanted to?
The city has the ability to act now. San Francisco has a fair amount of legal authority to provide services to its residents and so on. So the state legislation is the cleanest and sort of most straightforward way to do it, but the city definitely has some legal authority to take action.
And Alex Krall, you're a member of this task force then, as Laura just mentioned. What do you anticipate happening at these meetings? Where do you kind of see this process leading to?
Well, my role is as really the research member on the task force. As Laura mentioned, there's 15 members on the task force. So we're going to be reviewing the research that's happened around the world on this topic and looking at the pros and the cons and hopefully coming to some consensus about some recommendations for what would be best for both people who inject drugs but also for the communities.
Mm-hmm. And Gary McCoy, you have some experience with the city. Not that we're asking you to speak on behalf of the city, of course, but just your sense of city politics. Where do you think this task force is likely to end up?
Well, I don't know if you know, but I worked as a legislative aide for several of our supervisors, and so when I jumped on board with this after my initial opposition, I'd been very vocal about trying to get the information out there publicly and try to change public perception to see the positive aspects of this. And so, I think the task force is important because you can't refute data and research. And so I look forward to the report coming out at the end of the task force's sunset period so we can all see how this will benefit the city.
Mm-hmm. And we got a comment from Tom from Berkeley who has chronic pain, and he's concerned about whether doctors will stop prescribing opioid pain medication in response, I assume, to this opioid epidemic. So really the question here is, what will people do who have chronic pain, knowing that they may still need access to these drugs if we're going in this direction of trying to phase them out or criminalize them, as it sounds like Senator Feinstein wants to increase. The question for you, Laura Thomas, do you want to weigh in on that, respond to Tom?
Yeah, it's a legitimate concern. The opioid crisis was driven in part by pharmaceutical company marketing and overprescribing of opioids, but we can't let the pendulum swing too far back because it is exactly the chronic pain patients and pain patients generally who will have the most to lose if they lose access to their medication. In fact, that's one of the reasons we know why people end up turning to the illicit market and to using heroin when their prescriptions are cut off or they're no longer able to access medication for their pain.
Mm-hmm. And final thoughts, I want to go back to you, Gary McCoy. We only have about 30, 45 seconds left, but wanted to hear your final thoughts on this topic.
I'm glad we're finally taking a step in the right direction with this in San Francisco. And I really hope that, somewhere in the very near term, we can start seeing supervised injection facilities and safe consumption services. It's important, and it'll definitely save lives and hopefully give people more opportunities to improve their lives.
And for those who are interested in this topic, sounds like we've got a task force and a public process along that both Alex Krall and Laura Thomas, our guests here, are going to be a part of. So we encourage listeners to stay engaged. And I want to thank all these panelists for being here tonight. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests were Alex Krall, Director of the Behavioral and Urban Health Program at RTI International, Gary McCoy, HIV/AIDS activist and recovery advocate, and Laura Thomas, Deputy State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Thank you all so much for coming tonight and discussing this issue with our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank all of you for listening in. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Judith Sansone. Join us again next Monday, where City Vision's co-host Joseph Pache will be digging deeper into a San Francisco Chronicle investigative report about the criminalization of children in California's foster care facilities. That's next Monday on City Visions at 7 p.m. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.